Orchids have been a human obsession for centuries, and on Garden Talk today, we'll take a look at that history and answer your questions about growing them. I'm Jill Nadeau, and this is WPR News Network. Back with us is Erica Hanekel. She has been a master gardener for 15 years. She's grown orchids for 20. Erica's the author of Orchid Muse, A History of Obsession in 15 Flowers. She's a grant writer for Ashland County and a former professor of environmental history. What questions do you have for her about growing orchids, or what about other plants? Well, we'd like to hear from you. Join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hi, Erica. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me back on Garden Talk, Jill. This is really fun.
Great. We met, you were on with us in Bayfield, and when you were there, I found out about this wonderful book that you wrote, and it's a beautiful little thing, kind of like an orchid.
Thank you.
Yeah, great illustrations, what have you. When did you become enamored, I guess is a good word to use, with orchids?
Yeah. I originally grew up in Northern California, but I was in grad school at the University of Iowa in Iowa City. And so that was a big move. That was a very different sort of winter to live through. And then, you know, since moving to Northern Wisconsin, that's even a more intensely different winter. But it was back then that I was gifted a couple of grocery store phalaenopsis, you know, for birthdays or just gifts, and stumbled into making it rebloom, and just was like, wow, I can have beautiful flowers through the winter and not pay very much for them if I can figure out how to rebloom these. And so that grew into a collection of basically grocery store phalaenopsis into like 6 or 7, maybe 8. And then when moving to Northern Wisconsin, the length of the winter sort of really directly correlated to the size of my orchid collection and its increased variety. So growing beyond the phalaenopsis or the moth orchid.
Yeah, because that's kind of the gateway plant for most people who grow orchids, right?
Definitely.
They're beautiful and they're everywhere. And they're tempting, very tempting.
Yes.
So we'll get into a little bit later on, you know, how to keep them alive and get them to rebloom. But first, let's talk about your book a little bit. Like I said, it's really unique. Why don't you talk a little bit about how it's put together?
Yeah. So this was honestly my dream book to write. And I was a very unhappy camper when I finally had to turn the entire manuscript in, because it was just the project that just brought me so much joy. I was one of those extremely lucky people, you know, through part of COVID, I was able to write this during lockdown. Like, you know, I continued working, but also it was this moment to be able to work on this. So the concept for the book was that as an environmental historian, I had read several books about orchids. There aren't that many, but all of them really only focused on the deep sort of colonial history of orchids and really orchid extraction from South America and Africa and other places, the extraction by European and sometimes American explorers and botanists. And that's also happens to be, you know, what many orchid species are named after are either the people who extracted them, put their name on them, or the people who were the patrons of those explorers. They put their name on them as they sort of entered into the Linnaean naming system. And so, you know, people had covered the history of those explorers. And those are interesting stories. Those are exciting stories a lot of the time. But I was really interested in like, wait, what are all the other stories of all the other people that lived around these orchids before, or that still love these orchids and appreciate them in different ways around the world, including women, including people of color, including people across an economic spectrum? Because, you know, while in the 19th century, orchid collecting and growing really kind of was an elite hobby. They were just so rare and so expensive at that time. Now it's a hobby that's open to almost anyone. And even your non-grocery store phalaenopsis can be grown on a windowsill, and you might have to order it online or go to a specialty store, but they're still absolutely within the reach of kind of most Americans, I would say. Mm-hmm. So that's where that began. Like, how do I tell those stories that include a bigger cast of characters? And how can people sort of connect their lives into this larger, sort of seemingly more specific story about orchids? And I was able to kind of like pull out stories that, you know, I have always been a lover of, for example, Frida Kahlo's art, and her life is just kind of this crazy dream of pain and art and beauty and appreciation of nature, and had kind of noticed in her case specifically, and just looking through her decades worth of artistic talent, that only one significant painting that she ever made ever had one like very clear orchid in it. And that really struck me, because after growing orchids for 20 years, I know that Mexico is awash in orchids at all times of year, right? And so, we also know from the historical record that Diego Rivera and several of others of Frida's lovers brought her orchids at different times in her life. So she was surrounded in orchids. So she was making a particular choice to only paint that one orchid in that one canvas, and I think not paint orchids in other canvases where she included all kinds of other flowers, dahlias, roses, all kinds of spectacular colors and forms. So investigating that story, why that canvas, why that moment, what was she going through in her life, what did the meaning kind of ultimately be? And then, you know, just piecing together and digging a little deeper on lots of other people and interesting stories around the world.
And they are all around the world. You've got one in Japan, one in China, England, a couple of Darwins are in there.
That's right.
So, it's a really nice variety. And I think it's one of those books where you don't just plow through the whole thing. You just maybe enjoy one chapter at a time. And at the end of every chapter, you feature an orchid and give some information about it. Why did you decide to do it that way?
Yeah. Because I thought my core audience, of course, would be people who were already orchid lovers, I did want to offer hands-on information about how to grow a specific orchid. Because, I mean, orchids get kind of a bad rap in that they are perceived as being very hard to grow. And that's because, you know, they really are kind of outside of or different than other types of houseplants that we might grow. But once you figure out just a couple of things, once you can kind of wrap your mind around thinking about most orchids just a little bit differently, a lot of people are very, very successful very quickly. And so, you know, beyond just orchid enthusiasts, I thought anybody who was gardening, anybody who was a houseplant nerd might also appreciate a book that offers a deep personal and cultural histories of orchids, and then how to get your fingers in it, right? How to like actually have this connection with this plant or this flower and understand that deeper history behind it. That, you know, it just, for me, it makes it so much more fun, even when I'm out in my back raised beds growing specific varieties of tomatoes. Like, just, I just love knowing those little stories that like people sort of come back to you as you're gardening.
Yeah, so. It makes it more special. Yeah. You know, one of the people that was in it, which I didn't realize that, but the actor Raymond Burr was a big orchid person, and he did some cultivating and coming up with new colors and things, didn't he? Talk a little bit about that.
He did. So he was, he lived in Southern California, of course, while he was an active as a big Hollywood actor and television actor. He then moved to California wine country and kind of expanded even more his orchid growing obsession. He really focused on Cattleyas and Vandas. So those are the warm growing, larger, many are fragrant types of orchids. Cattleya orchids are what the sort of like big giant orchid corsages used to be made out of through the like 30s, 40s, and 50s. And he became a sort of like very intuitive and hands-on hobbyist who then also did create a small business of making orchid hybrids. So crossing two types of orchids to get a new type of orchid. And he would name them after co-stars. He would name them after sea gods and sea nymphs. He had this like very interesting sort of like program of who do I want to honor today? Or what do I want to think about? What do I want to tie my orchids with in this kind of more magical realm of the sea or of Hollywood royalty together? And for me, his story was really poignant because he is a person who was closeted as a gay man for the grand majority of his life and yet was also bullied through most of his life. And so, you know, as a Hollywood actor, he had to effectively take out and date multiple Hollywood actresses to keep appearances up, but did not marry any of them. He had a whole sideline of like his PR team would make up stories about how many people he married, but all of his wives died in tragic accidents. And so at one time he had like the stories of like 3 and 4 wives that had died overseas tragically. But none of it was true. And it was all about sort of calming down that lavender scare around him so that he can continue to get work. And so he and his life partner actually worked on the orchid business together. And it was very clear in to me in reading the documents there that it just gave him this sense of peace. It gave him this connection with the natural world. It was a calming activity. It was an activity in which he could express joy and his ideas of beauty and connect with other people that appreciated those things too.
Yeah, I think most of us that do like to grow things can appreciate that because it does, you know, it can be frustrating when the weeds come in or whatever, but it's just a very calming kind of zen thing to do. So
yeah.
Our guest on Garden Talk today is Master Gardener Erica Hanekel. She is the author of Orchid Muse, A History of Obsession in 15 Flowers. What questions do you have about growing orchids? Do you have other gardening questions? Well, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Coming up at noon today, we'll talk about another ancient plant, beans. We have the author of the Bean Book with us to talk about the many varieties of heirloom beans that are out there and share some cooking tips and some recipes. And it's a great book if you are looking for some excellent and unusual bean recipes. So I hope you can stay with us for that. Right now we're talking orchids. Now, how do orchids, Erica, differ from regular houseplants when it comes to, you know, taking care of them and whatnot?
Yeah. So the first thing to really think about, and it honestly took me a few years to get there as an early orchid enthusiast, is to really, you need to center in your mind that most orchids that are popular today are epiphytes or lithophytes. And so that means that they grow on trees or they grow on rocks. Some of them grow in loam, right? Like more sort of denser, chunky kind of bark. But that is very different than most other houseplants because we're growing houseplants in soil, in pots. And so many orchids you can still grow in pots, but you need a lot chunkier, airier mix for the roots to get the air that they need. They need a lot of air, and orchids usually tend to need more moving air than other houseplants. And so I think that's maybe what one of the other reasons that people tend to stay away from orchids is that they kind of realize they need to buy other potting media and they'd rather just use the potting media that they have for all their other plants. I think the other thing about orchids is that, you know, depending on the genus and or the species that you choose, they can take very drastically sort of widely different lighting needs. Whereas, you know, and most things that are sold in garden centers as houseplants are pretty much low light plants. And there's a lot of orchids that are medium to high light plants and might even need a little bit of direct sun, which makes them perfect for a windowsill. Usually if that windowsill, you know, also has the kind of like temperature requirements, for ups and downs and, or just stable requirements depending on the orchid. So I actually only have one orchid in my entire collection of about 160, and that sounds obscene, but I will say that most of them are like teacup sized. So I grow them, you know, on carts and things. And so I swear I'm not a hoarder.
You don't live in a greenhouse?
I wish you did, but I live in northern Wisconsin, so a little bit off the mark for me and my pocketbook. But the kind of soil needs, I only have one orchid that actually grows in a kind of standard compost mix, and still I doctor that pretty much with a whole lot more perlite and a whole lot more sand. So again, that's that airiness thing. It still has that kind of like humusy base to it, but that orchid is Ludicia discolor, which is actually grown more for its foliage, which sort of tells you again that it sort of looks more like a standard house plant than for its flowers that a lot of other people might grow orchids for. But other than that, orchids are also similar to houseplants in that good maintenance pays off for both, right? So like a pothos or a dracaena or a Diffenbachia or any other type of kind of much more popular houseplant really benefits from getting on your calendar for a good repot. Getting into orchids upped my regular houseplant game quite a bit because I realized, you know, that dracaena, I have no idea when I repotted that. Was that 5 years ago? Yeah. Was that 7 years ago? And is that why it's not looking so great right now?
Could be.
Right. So they need, you know, because they're in such a contained environment, I would suggest, you know, get a tag, put the last time you repotted on it and stick it in the pot so that you will know, because at least all this information drops immediately out of my head. I don't keep any of that. So that you know that okay, it's 2 or 3 years later, it's 5 years later, I definitely need to repot this guy if he's going to do well. The other thing that carries over perfectly between orchids and other houseplants is giving it a shower. Almost all of your houseplants are plants that in the wild, where rain has fallen on them periodically or even multiple times a month. And so washing off all the dust, opening up all those pores, right? That this sort of like really rejuvenates them and makes them a lot healthier. And then the last thing I would say that really carries over through all types of plants is that, you know, fertilizing and the numbers on the fertilizer, the NPK, might differ between plants. You know, lower, sort of low and slow is almost always better for all plants rather than like huge doses at once. But what I will say is that my plant game was transformed when I started attending webinars about the importance of micronutrients too. And so, unfortunately, a lot of the big box stores really haven't got the message on that yet, but there are a lot of good houseplant foods and definitely good orchid fertilizers out there. where you'll get the NPK, but then it will also list micronutrients, and it might list just two more micronutrients. It might list five or even 10 more micronutrients. And the numbers that you really want to pay attention to for orchids are the calcium and the magnesium as well. Those two are highly mobile throughout plants in general, so that like NPK, the P and the K like tends to kind of sit there. It doesn't move a whole lot through the plant. Nitrogen cycles very quickly. Mm-hmm. But magnesium and calcium for most plants is moving very fast. And so they need sort of constant small bits of that. And so now for like all of my plants, outdoors, indoors, on the walls, like they're getting micronutrients as well.
Now I have seen sprays for orchids that you put on their leaves. Is that a good way to do it, or should it be into the soil?
It's okay. Again, as long as it has micronutrients, I do it, but I don't buy the stuff that's already in the bottle, mostly because I can't find one that has micronutrients. Usually it's just the NPK. It just has those macros. It doesn't have the micros. But especially if you are talking about something that is definitively epiphytic or lithophytic, and its roots, even if you put it in lovely chunky bark, it's got roots shooting out all over the place,
yeah.
Searching for things, kind of soaking those roots, maybe in the sink first, but then spraying it down with foliar fertilizer is a great option. What you don't want to do is take that wet plant and then stick it straight back in the sun, though. That's kind of a leaf burn situation,
sure.
That might be developing. But yeah, orchids especially have been shown to take up a whole lot of nutrients through their leaves, as well as sucking up through the velamen in their roots.
I've heard a lot of people say that what are all these roots sticking out, and I should cut those off, right? That's not a good idea, is it?
You really don't need to. I mean, if the orchid has healthy roots where you like to have them, then sure, you could cut a few. But I love to kind of embrace the wildness of orchids. Like, you know, it might have a couple roots going around. And truthfully, there is a whole like side of orchid growing that obsesses over the little green root tips, right? When it's actively growing, it's also a really good sign to you that when it has active green tips, instead of just sort of silver all the way down, mm-hmm. is that it's wanting more water. It's wanting more nutrients. This is the moment that I want to grow. Like, give me more. And so I might double the amount of times that I'm watering it during the week.
Mm-hmm.
I might give it slightly more fertilizer.
We are talking to Master Gardener Erica Hanekel. She's the author of Orchid Muse, A History of Obsession in 15 Flowers. And we're taking your questions. So please give us a call, 800-642-1234. We'll take questions about orchids, other inside plants, outside plants. Erica has the answer. So just give us a call. You can also send an email. That's talk at WPR.org. So what I did with my orchids, so I had them forever, like 2 or 3 years. They didn't rebloom. I was getting really, really frustrated. I'm like, fine, I'm just going to put you out on my back porch for the summer. And that next year, they bloomed. And I did it 2 years in a row. And they bloomed again. So what was it? Yeah, what was it about going out there in the real world that did that?
Yeah. So especially, I'm guessing there were Phalaenopsis, that the moth orchid, and this is really good for a huge swath of orchids that are popular today, but it's the temperature differentiation that is helping them to rebloom. So most orchids, again, it's really because it's such a huge family. Orchids are on every single continent except Antarctica, right? It's sort of hard to paint with a broad brush, but especially Phalaenopsis and several other genera, they really do like a kind of 10 to 15 degree Fahrenheit drop. And for most, you know, orchids that you grow that are bought in a grocery store or in a big box or ordered online are fairly complex in their hybridization. I think they are on their like 19th or 20th like combination of different hybridized orchids, right? The DNA here is like incredibly, incredibly mixed and advanced. And if you grow anything, you probably know about hybrid vigor, right? So the more that you sort of hybridize things, the stronger things usually get. And so these orchids still do want, however, some moving air. So maybe your porch had a little bit of moving air too. They do. It maybe it had a little bit higher humidity. Those things can help. It might be slightly marginal, but I would think that the keys were the temperature differentiation and possibly if it meant a little bit more light for your orchid, that could really help as well. Because as much as we need to keep a good fertilizing schedule, you know, orchids, like any other plants, eat light, right? The more light that they get without pushing them over the edge into burning is better for them. And so almost all orchids, you really want leaves to be in that grassy green sort of color area. There are orchids that are darker. I do have some larger hybrid Phalaenopsis that have a darker leaf. And usually a darker leaf will also kind of correlate to more a sort of darker flower. So like if I'll have a kind of burgundy flower, the leaf will be sort of almost purple green instead of a kind of grassy green. But the grassy greens for yellows and whites and oranges, in terms of flower color, is where you want to go. And so, and you also want to do that usually pretty slowly. So if you change an orchid's position to the light really, really drastically, it might suffer. So if you've got it 10 feet away from a window, maybe try to move it 5 feet closer and then let it adjust for 2 or 3 weeks and then move it another 3 feet closer and see what the leaves are doing kind of in each step of that of the way.
Mm-hmm. Debbie in Reedsburg, you have a question? Go right ahead.
Yeah, I've got an orchid species. It's called Catalea. And I cannot get those to bloom at all. I've got 4 other ones that are not that kind, but they're Phalaenopsis, but they're all blooming.
Good. Good. Thanks for calling, Debbie. So Cattleyas and Phalaenopsis really do grow quite differently. For Cattleyas, almost all of them are going to want a minimum of about 65 degrees like throughout the year. So if we take the lesson of the temperature differentiation applies across most orchids, Cattleyas, most of them, and again, Cattleya it is a very wide genus as well, but most that are grown popularly sort of want that base at 65, but to regularly go up to as far as 80, maybe even 82, 83. And so you do have to apply that kind of like higher amount of heat to it. Some of them can take short spurts at lower for just a few months at a time. The other thing about Cattleyas is Cattleyas need quite a bit more light than your Phalaenopsis or your Paphiopedilums. So Cattleyas can often, like in Wisconsin here, if you acclimatize it, you could probably be putting it in a southern window at least for winter if the sun is not like blazing for many, many, many hours at a time. But if it's getting some direct sun for a couple hours a day and it's ready for it, that will probably make it really happy. I think the other thing with Cattleyas to really think about is that the best way to water them and fertilize them is really kind of to dunk it, dunk as much of it as you can, including the leaves. Definitely the entire pot. Let it sit for a couple of hours that way in either just pure water or your fertilizer mix, and then drain it completely, right? Just sit and then set it, like drain it out for a couple of hours, and then let it go dry. Go not quite bone dry, not crispy dry, but cattleyas really like, I mean, the jungle environments that most cattleyas come from are very dry for long periods of time, and then they might get 6 inches of rain over 48 hours, right? And so they're that velamen, that silver lining, the thickness of the that covers the actual root inside, is sucking up all those nutrients and storing it for later to put on the weight when the plant wants to grow again. So yeah, I think I'm gonna guess it's probably a temperature thing. And it's maybe a light thing.
What about other varieties? Do we have to worry? What about, well, let's talk about watering first. And we've all seen the tags that say, put an ice cube in your orchid every week. And it just never seemed like a good idea to me. But, you know, what do you recommend?
It's really not a good idea to water any orchid with ice cubes. Because if you think about it, if an orchid is adapted to living in a home environment, it's adapted to temperatures that probably range between 60 and 80 degrees. And putting 32 degree ice on orchid roots is not a good idea. Even if it's at the top and it's not touching, it's dripping actually too little water, far too little water, but very cold water. And that can shock the plant, but as with cattleyas, almost all orchids really do like a kind of dunk and then slightly dry. There are exceptions. Paphiopedilums, many of them sort of really like it just a little bit moist. And so you'll kind of get a little bit denser a kind of potting media for Paphiopedilums, the slipper or pouch orchids that grow indoors. Watering otherwise, it is, I would say it's probably the single biggest hurdle for most people who want to grow their orchid collection, especially if they want to diversify their orchid collection. So if you've figured out watering for Phalaenopsis, or perhaps if you want to get into orchids, but you know that with your other houseplants, you are an overwaterer or an underwaterer, I might make some different recommendations for what you might want to grow, because there are certain orchid genera that I have found, at least as a habitual overwaterer for most of my life, that will grow for me and grow very happily for me. Whereas I've got to really, really, really hold myself back to underwater some other types of things. And cattleyas are one of them, truthfully.
Well, I'm a little more neglectful, so I do just fine.
No, that's good. That's good. Honestly, you're probably better off.
Our guest on Garden Talk today is Master Gardener Erica Hanekel. She's the author of Orchid Muse, A History of Obsession in 15 Flowers. What questions do you have about growing orchids? Or do you have any other gardening questions? Join in by calling 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Join us again on the Larry Mueller Show Monday. Our physical therapists are back, and they're going to talk about strengthening after you have a hip replacement and, of course, help you with your other physical therapy questions. But right now, we are talking orchids with Erica Hanekel. If you've got a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234. So one of the things I've wondered about is, do we have to be concerned about pests and diseases with orchids as much as we do with some of our other indoor plants?
Unfortunately, yes. the big pests for orchids are generally also the big pests for all other houseplants. So mealybug, thrips, red spider mite, other types of spider mite. And treatments vary. Some things that you can use on houseplants, you don't use on orchids, and vice versa. There are also orchid-specific diseases that are pretty devastating, and then other diseases that are not specific to orchids, but that carry over to orchids. And so one of the things that I highly recommend to the beginner and everyone else out there is when you bring a new plant into your home, don't stick it in the middle of the other plants that are doing well, right? You actually do need to quarantine all of these things for, it's a pretty good long time. I quarantine no less than 6 weeks. And that can be difficult. If you've got a big habit and you're bringing stuff into your house, you've got a lot of little micro zones that you're kind of monitoring at the same time. But truthfully, it absolutely pays off, right? To kind of like, oh God, I feel like we've probably all learned the lesson of, yes, like, this thing looks so healthy and beautiful, I'll just put it right here and make a nice little display. And then 3 weeks later, like, everything is crawling with mealybugs.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
No.
It's a nightmare.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones. In Ripon, we've got Chris. Go ahead, Chris.
Hi. Just had a question. I've always liked orchids and thought it would be neat to try to grow them just for, you know, one's own enjoyment. But I've always been under the impression that it needs to be a really humid environment, like a greenhouse, you know, with moisture dripping down the walls. I'm in an apartment. I think I've got plenty of sun, and from what I hear from you, I think the temperature range would be fine. Just kind of wondering about the humidity. And also, does your book have a sort of a how-to component for fledgling growers?
Thank you so much for these questions, Chris. This is awesome. Yes, the book does have how-tos. It actually has three or four appendices that will teach you about the parts of different types of orchids so that you know, like, when you're reading about it, you'll know the different parts. It also has a glossary, so major terms in orchid growing that you can learn about. It also has a list of my top 15 tips for growing orchids, all types of orchids. And then it's got 15 kind of spotlight orchids that teach you how to grow a specific orchid, but can be generalized to the orchid genus that it is within. So hopefully my book should help you. I love talking to people that are kind of just getting into this. So humidity is a really great question. I would say if your apartment stays at around 40% humidity year round, you're absolutely good to go with almost all orchids. So the idea that, like, orchids come from hot, steamy jungles is true in some respects, but sadly, during the 19th century, this was actually the number one reason for their death, or maybe number two reason for their death, was when they would get extracted from places and brought back to Europe in very hot, steamy hothouses, it was actually way too hot. And they can take kind of lower humidity. My house is actually has very low humidity in the winter. I can sometimes get down to, like, you know, 10% humidity and rarely over 25% humidity. So I have created little kind of oases on orchid carts that have a kind of plastic sheet over them to keep up humidity, to get it to, and I don't push it to 80 or 90% because then you're just inviting mold and kind of grodiness. But if you can get it to 40, it's kind of perfect. The other way to get around that, though, is I do have orchids around my very low humidity home, but I just need to take them to the sink and give them that dunk probably twice a week. so that they get that refresher of feeling all of their pores full again, and then they can go back to the spot that they were at. I will say that over the decades, as I've been growing, my most fun project that also did increase humidity for me quite a bit was that my first COVID lockdown project was to create an orchid cabinet for myself. So I took an old trophy cabinet that I bought for super cheap from a friend, which had glass on three sides. And, you know, it is not fully enclosed at all. It does have some air movement in there, but I put small fans. It's got a seedling heat mat to give me the sort of slightly higher temperature differential than a home might have. And it has precise lighting for exactly what you want. And then you put, you know, pieces of glassware, or I have small hanging orchids within it. And that is just, my gosh, that thing just cranks out the blooms because I've sort of targeted it. So they've got the temperature range, the humidity is at, you know, 40 to 60, never goes above, never goes below. And it's got the lighting on a timer, and it's like, wow, this thing kind of runs itself. If you're starting on windowsills though, it's absolutely possible. And yeah, I mean, getting down to 10% humidity is actually not healthy for even humans. Like, so, you know, we need to run more humidifiers in several rooms of our house. But they can take it. I will say, if you get much below 30% humidity, the pests have a heyday with it. And that's another really good reason to wash your orchids or wash your plants regularly with just tepid water, not freezing cold, not boiling hot, right? If you have a little sprayer, take it to the sink and spray it down, because that just washes off pest activity as well, is really the easiest way.
Okay.
So thanks so much.
Thanks, Chris. We really appreciate that. And go and buy yourself one. Marilyn in Lake Geneva, you're up next. Go right ahead.
Hi. I got an orchid for a gift, you know, one of those grocery store orchids a number of years ago, several years ago now. And when it got done blooming, I didn't know quite what to do with it. So I cut off the top of it, the stalk, but the rest of the stalk is still there. And the plant seems to be doing well in the north window that it's in. It started out with two of those kind of leathery leaves, and now it has six leaves. But it's not, I don't know how to remove that stalk in case I want, if it ever wanted to bloom for me.
Yeah. So with Phalaenopsis, you're doing the right thing. If you've got six new leaves, it's putting on weight. It's just ready to go. And this is actually the perfect time of year to do this. Can you find a place in your house that has dappled light, but will give it that temperature differential? The temperature could even go down into the 50s at night and then pop back up to the mid 60s during the day. But Phalaenopsis, really, that for some reason will really trigger it. It also works to do that for, you know, longer periods, but at slightly higher temperatures, but across, you know, the whole year. But this is actually when I do my Phalaenopsis. Like, at some point in October, I'll move them closer to into a cooler room in my house and give them about 2 weeks of a slight chill, right? You don't want to drop into the 40s and definitely not the 30s. But into the 50s, they're perfectly fine. And it sort of triggers it into reblooming. With the stalk, you did the right thing. You can just cut off sort of right where the flowers have been blooming, because in the nodes in the stalk going down, there is more potential. Your orchid could put out another spike out of one of those nodes. The one thing about that is that it's not very pretty. It's like you have the straight up stalk, and then the next orchid spike just sort of comes out straight. So it sort of like looks like an upside down L. The other thing you could do, because it hasn't bloomed in a couple of years, I might say, go ahead and cut the stalk back to the stem, right? Cut it all the way down, give it the cold treatment and see where it goes. I think, you know, after you give it the slightly cooler treatment, then moving it into a zone that's in a low of 60s, low mid 60s, and some good dappled light, it should be good to go.
Okay, good luck, Marilyn. We've got a couple of emails here. And one of these probably makes a lot of sense for what we're just talking about. Merritt emailed to ask, how long does the cold period need to be to get a phalaenopsis to bloom again?
I would say 2 weeks is good. A month is probably better.
Okay.
But you need to really make sure that it doesn't drop below 50. Mm-hmm. So like if you have sort of like a back mud room, and at this time of year, it'll get into the 50s. But if you're pushing into November, December, it'll get down in the 40s, and you really don't want that. Yeah. So just keep an eye on it.
Sure. Monica emailed. She's in Milwaukee, and she's wondering if you could give some recommendations on where to purchase a cymbidium orchid in Wisconsin or online. She's been looking for the deep lemon yellow blossoms with a ruby throat.
I love cymbidium so much. And they are really well adapted to life in Wisconsin for a longer period outside than most other orchids, because most cymbidiums can take it really all the way down to the low 30s, but sort of not too much past freezing. I would suggest Orchids Limited, number one, in Plymouth, which is outside of Minneapolis. They are an incredibly well-respected, famous breeder, growers, wonderful family of orchid enthusiasts. They have really specialties in Neophoenicia orchids and Phragmipedium orchids, but they will have some cymbidiums. Where one of my favorite places to order cymbidiums online is a place called the Santa Barbara Orchid Estate. And they have a website, and they have many dozens of varieties. Since I have a limited space, I actually, as much as I love cymbidiums, I only have one standard size cymbidium. And when I say standard, the sucker is like 4 feet tall and 3 feet wide. Like, they're so gigantic. Like, I can't have more than that. But it's got this gorgeous maroon flower that smells like grapes, like intensely in the dead of winter. But the reason why I bring up the Santa Barbara Orchid Estate is that they also have miniature cymbidiums, so that their leaves still might get to 18 inches, but they're much more petite and they grow lovely scented flowers. And you might be talking about, I don't know if you're with the yellow with the ruby throat. I know that there are varieties of Cymbidium encifolium that come in that style. And that's Cymbidium encifolium is naturally a sort of more petite cymbidium. And there's actually a chapter on that orchid in the book
wanted
to know a bit more of the history.
Great. Well, thank you, Monica. I hope that helped. And just really quickly here, Lisa emailed to say that even if you don't think of yourself as an orchid lover, Erica's book is an intriguing, fun, and often mysterious story that winds through time, exotic locations, and unique historical periods of time when explorers traveled around the world in search of this jewel of a plant. Lisa says it is a great holiday gift to the nature lover in your life. Well, how sweet is that?
Ooh, thank you.
So on that note, thank you, Erica, for being with us, and I'm sure we will talk again soon.
Thanks so much, Jill. This
You're
was
welcome.
Great.
We've been talking with Erica Hanekel on Garden Talk. She is a master gardener, and her book is called The Orchid Muse, A History of Obsession in 15 Flowers. Stay with us. We'll be talking about beans after the news.